I mean, the album is very much about my recovery process. I started writing the songs before and then continued writing afterwards. And I think it wasn't intentional, but I do think there's a bit of a story arc there.
Well, hello again, Memphis, and welcome to Storyboard 30. Storyboard 30 is taken right out of the pages of Storyboard Memphis, the nonprofit publication that takes you behind the scenes in local arts, community, and culture. And I am Mark Fleischer, your host for Storyboard 30. My guest today is J.D. Rieger. J.D. is a local musician, record producer, engineer, and promoter, as well as a podcaster, all under the title and label he created, Back to the Light. J.D. and I sat down in September to talk about his podcast and his music career here in Memphis, but we also took a deep dive into our shared experiences with sobriety and recovery, the challenges and pain that comes with each, but also how the experience in both areas have informed our work here in Memphis. J.D. and I sat down in the beautiful main sound room of the Memphis Listening Lab, located at Crosstown Concourse. And there, a special thanks goes to Jim Cole, librarian and archivist of the Listening Lab, for use of the space. And thanks also to J.D. Rieger for allowing us to play a few cuts from his forthcoming album, Where Wasn't I? So, J.D. Rieger, welcome to Storyboard 30.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me.
You know, before we get into our conversation today, I definitely got to talk about where we are, you know. I've been in this space a few times. I can't say I've dropped a needle in here yet, and I'm talking about a diamond needle, you know, on vinyl. I have not done that, but this space, the Listening Lab, is one of the best things we've got in Memphis. I just love it. You've recorded here. What's your experience here?
Yeah, I'd be lying if I didn't tell you that the Listening Lab was one of the many things that called me back to Memphis from Chicago. I loved the idea of it before I even saw it. And then when I came down here and saw it, I immediately said, you know, let's set something up. Let's do some sort of podcast taping here. And we did. And now I do stuff here regularly. The Shangri-La Records podcast, which I host, also tapes all of our episodes here. So
cool.
Yeah, I love this space. It's beautiful. It's a great idea. The vibe in here is great. Jim Cole is a beautiful person.
Yeah. Hear, hear.
Yeah.
And we're in the main listening room. So, you know, to my right, we've got two big old turntables and a sound system, and we're surrounded by CDs and vinyl albums, and it's just a great space. So listeners, if you're into some good old fashioned, put the headphones on and grab a listen. This is the place to be.
Yeah. And they have lots of public, listening parties and not just podcast stuff, but all kinds of, you know, musical, Memphis music related content here. It's a great space.
Yeah. So JD, so you have a history, obviously, in Memphis, born and raised, going back to the sub-teens. And for me, not growing up here, I had really zero knowledge of the sub-teens. So forgive me for that. But let's go back to those days first. Tell me about the sub-teens.
Well, the sub-teens were a band that I've been doing shows with since, 1994, 1995. My band at the time, the Henrys, played with them. We played shows in Bartlett Park and on Highland Strip and places like that. And we've just stayed in touch ever since. And their drummer, Bubba John Bonds, is also my drummer in the Cold-Blooded Three. So when I heard that they were starting to write some songs again and looking for a place to record, I immediately said, please let me produce it. So that's what happened. Actually, they said yes.
Yeah. What's the style for those listeners who aren't aware?
I would call it, post-punk or something like that. It's very reminiscent, I would say, of the Replacements, Husker Du, that era of punk rock. Lots of pop hooks, heavy pop hooks, but still rocking. Short songs.
Yeah. Yeah, I was given a listen to some of the new stuff and also some of the old stuff, and I heard a little bit of the Replacements in there. I heard some some British punk.
Oh, they're huge Sex Pistols fans too, definitely.
Yeah, I heard a little bit of that. I forget where I read this, but I heard it also in some of the recordings, like a smidge, a touch of AC/DC.
Oh, sure. I read that. Sure, yeah. Especially the drummer, Bubba John, is a big AC/DC fan. They all are. They love that stuff too. Kiss, Van Halen. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. And you were in the, I'll say, industry for a good 20-something years.
Yeah, I've worked for record labels, and I also covered Memphis music from the Memphis Flyer and other outlets for over 20 years. So, yes, you could say that.
Yeah. So, fast forward then to the opportunity you and your wife got a few years ago going to Chicago.
It was really more the opportunity that she got. She got a job that she still has, actually, working for the Art Institute of Chicago.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
She works in development, which is fundraising, basically. And it was, you know, one of those dream scenarios. She got the job. We had to go. I had to go. Her partner had to be done.
Yeah.
So we lived there for 5 years. And then, you know, she's been working remotely since 2020. And it just became apparent that there was really no reason we had to stay. And I had so much going on in Memphis that it was cheaper to just move back instead of me flying back every couple of months.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What was it like for you personally leaving Memphis? Do you feel like it was a good time for you, or did you feel like...
I thought it was the right thing at the time, definitely, because yeah. I was burned out. I was pretty burned out, and I was not in a good place mentally. I was pretty depressed, and I was drinking a lot. And it did not get better when I moved to Chicago and found myself with no band and no friends. And I found a pretty, most people would think it was a good job. I ended up hating it, but I got a job pretty quickly, but not much else really seemed to work out for me in Chicago. So, and then, you know, once I started the podcast and the label and everything started going here, it was just really painful to be in Chicago at that point, so I had to come home.
So this is so interesting to me that you've got the Back to the Light podcast, which is also a label, right?
It is, yes.
Yeah.
By necessity, not by like any grand design to take over the media world or anything. It's just somebody has to put these records out, and I'm here to do it.
So I'm really curious, how did the idea of marrying a podcast with a label, you said by necessity, but how did that...
Well, a little bit of the inspiration I'll give to my friend Tim Regan from the band Snow Globe. He has a thing in Texas that, oh gosh, the name of it even escapes me right now, but it's like a booking agency and a record label and all kinds of things all in one. I was like, that makes a lot of sense to just have everything be called one thing. Uh-huh. Instead of tell people, oh, this is my podcast and this is my record label and this is the name of my band and this is the name of the salad dressing that I make on the side. You know, I can just say I do Back to the Light and then you can just find it all in one place.
Yeah. Where did the name come from?
It came from the recovery process.
Yeah.
It came from the fact I originally wanted to call it Out of the Dark, but I found that there were so many things already called Out of the Dark, and I just, Back to the Light was just another way to say it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. If we talk about that a bit,
I wouldn't have named it Back to the Light if I didn't ask. I'm asking for the question.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. So speaking from experience, you know, myself having gone through a recovery process as well, 5-something years ago, I know from my experience that my process informed my work. So for you, let's go back to your time in Chicago. What was the feeling like, you know, before you realized I've got to make a change. I can't live like this anymore. I can't do this anymore.
Well, I was working a job that I hated. I was miserable. I wasn't making any music. I wasn't doing a podcast. I wasn't in very good contact with my friends in Memphis or anywhere. I was pretty much just out in an island in Chicago drinking myself to death and, you know, feeling plenty sorry for myself. You know, eventually I just couldn't do it anymore. It got to be too physically painful, too emotionally painful. I decided I had enough. I had a friend of a friend in the therapy game in Chicago, friend of a coworker. And I asked if she knew any good therapists, and she went to some super secret Facebook therapist group that she knew of and found somebody who was available for me. And it just so happened that it was the right call. My therapist would say that I saved my life, but I like to give her credit anyway.
Yeah. I
had a lot of childhood trauma that I just was not dealing with. And I had been trying to numb the pain of it for decades. And it finally reached it was no longer manageable. I was a functional alcoholic for years, but it reached a point to where I was no longer functional. I could barely eat. My sleeping was all jacked up. I was miserable. I mean, I was physically and emotionally just exhausted and miserable. And so I got a therapist, and I remember the last shot of whiskey that I took to, you know, steal off the shakes. And I remember thinking, that's it, never again. And I've stuck to it. It's been over 3 years.
Good. Congratulations there.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah.
The therapy is what did it though, really. I mean, you know, I don't think I would have stuck to it if I didn't have a therapist I had a therapist here in Memphis too, but this one in Chicago, I don't know what exactly clicked, but I didn't believe that I could lie to her. I didn't believe that I could BS her.
Yeah.
I couldn't cover it up the way I could cover it up with my previous therapists.
Right. Right.
So I just decided to be completely honest and truthful. And to do that, I knew I would have to quit drinking, or else I'd have to tell my therapist how much I was drinking. And I was like, well, Jesus Christ, I don't want to do that.
Yeah.
I can't go in there every week and be like, yeah, doc, I drank a fifth of whiskey every day. Like, who would put up with that? So I stopped.
Yeah. Well, you know, nowadays, I think so many of us can relate to your experience. You know, we know the statistics during the pandemic, right?
Yeah.
That it's the same. It's so much of what you just described. Isolated, at home, you know, losing a sense of purpose, whatever.
I laughed a little bit because it's not funny, but I know everyone else had this miserable experience in the pandemic, but for me, the pandemic saved my life because it got me out of a job experience that I hated, and it pushed me out of the nest and said, you know,
do something
else. Do your own thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I don't know, good Lord, if it hadn't happened, I might still be sitting there miserable. I mean, thankfully I was already in therapy and not drinking at that point. If the pandemic had hit and I was still in that place mentally, I think it could have been a disaster for me, honestly. But I had about 9-month head start on the pandemic of sobriety. So that helped a ton.
Yeah.
That helped a ton.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you find, so one, being in the music scene, and two, in Memphis, do you find it more of a challenge to be sober in this scene?
I probably did at one time.
Mm-hmm.
And I can see why it would be hard for someone to quit, because, I mean, all your venues are nightclubs where they sell beer and shots of whiskey. And if you're in the band, you either get it for free or get a sweet discount.
Yeah.
So happens.
It's part of the life.
But it's in no way attractive to me. You know, I see a shot of whiskey on the table and I just see pain.
Yeah.
You know, so like, no thank you is easy for me to say.
Yeah.
But I know it's harder for other people.
Yeah. Yeah. So from that experience, you start the podcast. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The first few episodes are pretty painful to listen to, actually, because I'm really just like rambling into a microphone about my feelings and about losing the job and what am I going to do and self-esteem and stuff like that. And about 10 episodes in, I started just like having conversations with people and like addressing those issues more naturally, I think. Mm-hmm. And that's where it sort of gathered steam.
Yeah. Did you find it, with your guests initially, did you find it difficult to engage in these conversations? Did you find it, were they open?
No, not difficult at all. I mean, I rarely, if ever, bring it up first when it comes to issues of mental health or recovery or whatever might be on my guest's mind. You know, we've talked about political things, certainly in the last few years with Trump and everything that has gone on. I usually just try to keep an open mind with my guest, and then whatever happens, happens. I've been told that I have a comforting presence and that I tend to bring out a willingness to share in my guests, but mm-hmm. you know, I can't really speak to that personally. I think it's a cool compliment and I appreciate it, but generally I don't have to. It just happens naturally. Maybe it's because they know my story and that's so they want to talk about it, or maybe it's because, you know, I'm just a nice guy. I don't know.
Well, I'll say from my experience, seeing the email, you know, from Marvin Stockwell. Thank you, Marvin. I felt immediately compelled to say, you know, hey, you know, I could probably talk about this a little bit, you know. So perhaps it's also the very fact that you're in the podcast and in general willing to openly talk about it. I feel like we're more open now to talking about issues of mental health. But also, once you remove maybe that first veil of, hey, it's okay to talk about this, that maybe that's another thing too. It's like, it's a relief in a sense. I can actually talk about this and talk about it to someone who understands.
Yeah. I mean, for me, I know this isn't necessarily true of everyone who recovers from alcoholism or chronic depression or whatever, but owning it was really helpful to me in a public way.
Owning it.
Part of, you know, part of my behavior was the secretiveness of it. I didn't go out and I wasn't one of these people that went out and got plowed in public generally. Although, I mean, there's a handful of ridiculous stories I could tell you, but generally speaking, when I was at my worst, I was home telling no one, you know, even, you know, trying to keep it on the down low from my wife, you know, I wasn't trying to broadcast it. So
yeah. And who at that point you don't want to.
Yeah. And when I initially quit, I actually didn't make like a big to-do of it. I didn't make a big Facebook post, and I still don't know the exact date. I don't know. I don't want to know, really. Not know it, not keeping score also helped a little bit. For some reason, I felt that like counting the days in previous time, for some reason that stressed me out, and I think it contributed to one of my crumblings. I don't know. So I don't know the exact date of when I quit or anything like that, but I don't know. That's a rambling answer. I don't know where I was going with that exactly, but owning it publicly was important. Yes.
Yeah. I think this is strictly what I, you know, think about sometimes, is that sometimes that the days, the months, the years for some are more of a stigma or a stress point versus having something to count backwards on and say, you know, I've done this, and it, you know, a sense of accomplishment or something, versus just being, you know. And it seems like for you, it's more about just being and being alive, right?
Yeah, for sure. One of the things I gave myself when I decided to quit was I gave myself permission to fail. Like, there were several times, like I remember me and Jennifer, my wife, went to Riot Fest when I was still pretty early on mm-hmm. in the process. And I said, you know, I told myself when we went, if you break down and you have a beer or two or something at this thing, it's not the end of the world. You haven't wrecked anything. You haven't mm-hmm. destroyed some ongoing, you know, effort to save your life. You haven't hit rock bottom again if you do this.
Mm-hmm.
And by removing that pressure, I didn't have a beer at Riot Fest. I never felt like I wanted to.
Yeah.
I know that doesn't work for everybody. Some people love the chip and the day count and the 10 years. And I give all love and respect to the people who need that and who want that completely, 100%. If it works for you, please.
Yeah.
But it didn't for me.
Yeah. So your experience that led to the podcast, and somewhere in there, the podcast married the label. Is that an accurate way to say it, or how did
sort
how
of? I had previously worked for a label in Memphis known as Makeshift Music, and we put out a ton of compilations and records by bands like Snow Globe and the Cochin Four, and one of my records back in the day. Bunch of bands, not just that. And so I'd always done this sort of thing eventually. I just thought, Back to the Light is a podcast, and it was already a podcast network, at least in theory at that point, because I was going to do the Shangri-La Records podcast, and I knew that I was going to try to tie them together in some way.
Mm-hmm.
So I just, again, thinking about my friend Tim Regan's project, which is called 9 Mile, by the way, I thought of it. I just, yeah, let's name everything Back to the Light. Why not?
Yeah. Now, see, this is, I was sitting here thinking about this, how this all is working and how you develop this. It's such a Memphis thing, right?
Well, Memphis, we work together. You know, that's the deal. Yeah. I have the ability to help my friends put out records and help a couple, you know, Shangri-La Records, long-standing Memphis record store institution. No reason for it not to have a podcast in today's climate. Ghana Records has all kinds of stuff. Every, you know, maybe you look at all the big record stores all over the world, they've all got all kinds of crazy content they're generating. So it just made sense.
Yeah.
And then I carry Marvin Stockwell's 2 podcasts also, Champions of the Lost Cause and Memphis Hardwood, the Grizzlies podcast.
Uh-huh.
And I also do I do a pro wrestling podcast also on the network called Of Marks and Men, which I'm very, very proud of as well. And also, I don't know how much plugging we can do, but I also have an article coming out in the Daily Memphian about Memphis pro wrestling.
Oh, excellent. Okay.
Yeah.
No, we can plug that for sure. Yeah.
It'll be out Tuesday the 27th.
Okay. Excellent. So by the time you listeners will be hearing this, the article would have already been out. So
yeah, it's out. Look it up. Daily Memphian.
Yeah.
Pro wrestling.
All right. Cool. Excellent. Okay, I'm just going to be a total fan for one sec. I'm not going to put this in the podcast. I'm kind of being a huge, just geeking out for a second because this is just really cool you've done this. So I'll say it. I'll say, how can I do this without sounding like a total geek?
It's fine. I sound like, if you heard my podcast, this is probably the best question. These are the questions that should be in the show, probably. But go ahead.
No, this is really something because, you know, I came to Memphis with nothing, essentially. Me and my wife. My wife, you know, she already had her job getting here. She was in the medical field. And I came here having just been laid off from a job and a career that I'd been in for 25 years in the corporate world. And so I came here, I had to do some heavy duty, you know, business networking like crazy. I went to every networking event you could think of, I went to it. And part of that experience and part of my own personal experience with recovery and whatnot led to this thing called Storyboard, which, you know, the idea is to bring people together. And what I'm really marveling over is the fact that you've done much the same thing in a different way with a different medium. But I always get the sense that some of this kind of stuff just doesn't happen elsewhere. It happens here in Memphis, you know?
That's probably true. I mean, I don't know. I'll probably make somebody mad saying this, but I definitely didn't get the same cooperative, collaborative vibes in the Chicago music scene that I get here.
Yeah.
And it's just a, even in just in general, Chicago is more of a gatekeepy, keep it for yourself kind of a town, whereas Memphis is more of a welcome stranger. Let me, whose phone number do you need? Kind of a town.
Yeah.
You know, it's very different. It's a very different vibe. Maybe it's the South. You know, I don't know.
Yeah. Well, okay. This is interesting because I at lunch today, I was having a conversation about media and whatnot, and sitting there having this conversation with a couple colleagues, and up walks this guy. He says, "I'm sorry, were you all talking about local media? You're all in local media?" And we said, "Yeah." He said, "Well, I'm from Cleveland, and we have a publication. It's an online-only publication." And we started talking, and of course, Cleveland is where the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is.
Don't remind me.
Right. And he was talking about the openness as we were talking about how we handle things in the local media, where we do try to collaborate, we do try to work together. And he was basically saying, "No, that's not how it's done in Cleveland." He said, I have the heck of a time trying to find or trying to get cooperation from basically the local organizations, their tourism board and so on and so on, that he never got any headway there. So you're talking about Chicago, and sorry, Chicagoans, and, you know, Cleveland, sorry,
Clevelanders.
Clevelanders. But
Guardians.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Whatever they are.
Yeah, but yeah. But it's just interesting. I'm sorry, listeners, I'm boring the crap out of you by saying this once again, but it feels like a Memphis thing. This sense of togetherness, and we're in this together.
Yeah. It was technically born in Chicago, but I think of it as being very much of Memphis, in as much that I am of Memphis. So yes, I agree.
Yeah, I could almost sense your ideas churning in Chicago, going, this is something that I'm going to have to do this in Memphis type
yeah.
thing.
Yeah, I mean, again, a lot of it was, you know, just doing that first podcast taping we did here at the Listening Lab. I was like, there's nowhere for me like this in Chicago. And Chicago's a great big place. Maybe there was someplace like this. I just never found it, and no one gave me the keys to it in a way that I have. You know, I'm not trying to brag or anything. I don't, like, run the show here or anything. But, you know, it's a very open and collaborative space. If you've got a even halfway legitimate idea for something to do, they're going to hear you out here.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you're exactly right, because, you know, Jim Cole, who runs it here, you know, I approached him just via email just a few days ago and said, "Hey, can we record in here?" He said, "Yeah, just come on in."
Yeah, if they're open and it's a, you know, it's not too disruptive, they're going to let you do it here.
Yeah, yeah. And see, that's another, to me, very Memphis thing, you know.
Yeah, a lot, you know, maybe in Chicago or wherever else, you know, the place, the equivalent place would be, no, we only do our in-house stuff here, you know.
Right, right.
Probably.
Yeah. So the podcast, you obviously talk about more than just issues of mental health. You also talk about music, right?
Not just music, even. I've had comedians and film directors and a couple of pro wrestlers and activists, all kinds of folks, really people I'm connected to, usually people I'm either friends with or a fan of in some way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you can find it, of course, on all the local, you know,
of
stuff.
Of course. Right, yes. Yeah. It's at backtothelight.net and everywhere you find podcasts, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, all those places.
Yeah. So in addition to all this, you also have a couple of albums coming out.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank goodness. my new record, which is called Where Wasn't I? Kind of, I don't know if anyone gets it, but it's funny to me. Mm-hmm. And then the new Subteens record, which I'm very, very proud to have produced, both come out October 14th. They'll be everywhere you find music digitally, and they're also on on vinyl, on LP. They'll be in stores also.
And you have a listening party. Am I correct?
Yeah, we have a listening party here at the Memphis Listening Lab on October 6th. And then we also have a release show at the High Tone October 14th. And I'm throwing a big festival October 15th at Wiseacre's downtown tap room. Listening Lab and Wiseacre are both free shows open to the public. High Tone is a late night rock show, so we do charge a cover.
Yeah. Now, you are primarily an engineer and a producer.
I don't know if that's primarily. I mean, I do. I mean, especially considering the amount of podcasts I produce these days, that's actually, I guess, accurate. But I'm a musician first and foremost. I still pretend.
So that's what I want to ask you about: is as a musician. So you play which?
I play them all, baby. I started on drums, and then eventually worked my way to bass and guitar. I play a little bit of keyboards and stuff. I play all the synthesizers or most of them on my new record. And I obviously write songs and sing them too. So most of the time these days I just play guitar and sing, but I have been playing drums the longest technically.
Yeah. What are some of your favorite bands out there right now, locally? Besides yourself.
Oh, besides myself. And the Subteens.
And the Subteens, yeah.
I like a lot of older bands, of course. I love the Grifters and I love the Simpletones. I love Pez, which I was in for like 5 minutes, but it barely counts. Pez is a great band. Mm-hmm. Currently, Little Baby Tendencies is a cool band. Mystic Light Casino, I've got some friends in that band. They're really coming together lately. I love that band. Jeremy Scott, his band, The Drip Edges, I put out their new record on Back to the Light. It's great. Loose Opinions. I could just name bands on my label if you want. No, there's so much good music in Memphis. I could name all my friends' bands, but I'd hate to leave everyone out, so maybe I'll just stop there.
Gotcha, yeah. Some of the songs you've recorded, let's think about some of the songs you recorded for the new albums.
Okay.
They seemed like, so I paid a listen, of course. I could tell some were informed by recovery and whatnot to a degree. Can you talk to anyone, any of them specifically that were?
Well, some of them were informed by lack of recovery, I would say.
Okay.
Also.
Yeah.
But the ones that were written afterwards, track 12, cut 12, Waking Life is pretty informed by the recovery process. There's a call to action of some, so to speak, in it, I think, you know. Are we allowed to curse on this podcast? Time to get our
I'll bleep it for WYPL, but you can curse.
It's pretty much a call to get my shit together.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know if that's the one you were thinking of necessarily. There are little bits in there in all of them probably. Another one that comes to mind is one called It Meant Everything, which is sort of about, I used to have a very negative view of my history and past, and through the clarity of being free of alcohol, I've actually been able to see that, like, little things, the friendships and connections and the tiny moments, actually none of it was a waste. It was all valuable. And you know, now I look back and I regret drinking through so much of it. You know, I wish I had more clear memories of some of it, because it did literally mean everything.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Trauma, you know, I've learned this, and I'm sure you've learned it too. There's what they call big T traumas and little T traumas.
Mm-hmm.
We all experience a series of little T traumas that just add up to one big thing.
Sure. I've had some big T ones too.
Yeah, and I have too, I'll have to say. But yeah, yeah. And so looking back, I guess you look back and go, not only I survived this, but I can use this experience to help others.
Yeah, I hope that it's comforting. I do think that it's a sad cliche, but it has to come from inside the person who is struggling. Mm-hmm. You know, there's no song or no thoughtful text or whatever that's going to make someone finally get help for themselves. But if I can provide a little bit of comfort and help them to know that they're not alone and that they can work their way out of it too, maybe like I did, then it's about providing hope.
Yeah.
That's usually what is in short supply in those times is hope. Mm-hmm. And if I can just give someone that little bit by letting them know that I went through some heavy stuff and made my way out of it, then that's very rewarding to me. And that's what you hope to do as an artist, is communicate to reach someone like that.
Yeah. And see, that's the beauty to me also of music, is that you can, as the artist, you can produce something. And once you produce that piece, once it's on vinyl, once it's, you know, out in the world, it is up to interpretation from the listener. So the listener might hear something totally different and might grab like one phrase.
Yeah.
I go, oh, that phrase, man, that's me.
And I try to write about myself very truthfully, but I also try to leave it just like, I try to write, not to write so hyper specifically that it would not be relatable. Mm-hmm. I try to keep it just vague enough, I guess.
Yeah.
To where it can apply, you know, maybe someone else hears that line and it means something completely different to them. It's sort of the Nirvana school of lyric writing, I guess. It's open to interpretation. So it could have been a toss-off fill-in line for me. I wouldn't want to sell any of them short, but
the toss-off lines are sometimes the ones that people will end up, like John Lennon is a good example where, you know, he has written things that he said were meaningless, and
yeah,
it becomes, you know, someone's catchphrase or whatever.
Yeah, you never know what someone's going to connect with. So yeah, I try to write about myself very truthfully and openly, but you know, not painfully specifically.
Yeah. Yeah.
In the podcast though, all bets are off. And that's kind of the cool contrast to the two, is that, you know, the podcast is an ongoing conversation. We can get as deep or hyper specific as we want to. The songs, once they're recorded, once they're out, there they are, and hopefully they're a bit more universal.
I must be searching for something, 'cause I can't let go of this thing. Took off my hat and my jacket and left them in the rain.
Your skills as a musician before and after, and your, I guess, the passion in your artistry before and after.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel they're different? I can, but they're the same, right?
Well, kind of. I mean, I don't want to make it sound like I'm getting old and decrepit, but at 43, there are certain, my skill set is different than it used to be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can't beat the drums at like full volume on 10 for 3 hours straight and never take a break the way I used to.
Yeah.
certain skills. So there are certain aspects that are different, just naturally, I think. I read a thing recently where at roughly the age that I'm at, you know, your skill set changes where you become a better teacher and not quite as good of a doer. And I think that ties into my career arc, you know, mm-hmm. what I'm doing with the podcast and the label and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
It makes sense, although I certainly still think of myself as a doer.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, yeah.
Yeah.
The passion behind it, though. You ever find that feels different?
For sure, because, I mean, you can tell just by how long it took me to put out my third solo record. The gap between my second and third record is a lot longer than the one between my first and second.
Yeah.
Because there were several years there where I barely touched it.
Mm-hmm.
I barely touched a guitar. I didn't care. In fact, I drank heavily to kill my artistic impulses because I had reached a point with it where doing it, I was frustrated with perceived lack of success and, you know, whatever, all the terrible artistic cliches that you could imagine. So, yeah, I was trying to kill it. I was trying to kill my ambition. When I quit drinking, it all came back.
That was one of the fears I had. You know, I don't consider myself an artist at all, but I have it in my DNA. I just can't always execute it the same way. But I always found that...
I consider a podcast an art, so...
Well, there you go. Okay, good. But there was a period there where I was concerned, well, is music going to sound different to me? Is, you know...
I will admit that I did have those thoughts, will I still be able to write those deep, painful things? You know, I for a very, very long time, I did have a romantic notion of depression that I thought that depression fueled my creativity and, you know, I don't know, maybe it did a little bit to an extent, but there was a point at which I had long passed that it was productive. That it was helpful.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
I mean, I think, you know, a certain amount of pain and life experience to inform your artistic perspective is good for any artist.
Yeah.
It's any person. But yeah, I don't really believe you don't have to be like in the deepest pit of despair to write a meaningful song.
Yeah.
That's ridiculous now that I think of it.
Yeah. I look back at like, you know, Hemingway or something, and you go, how did they do it? You know, I mean, really drinking through the whole process.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, all my heroes or half of them are, you know, artists who died young.
Yeah.
Or wrestlers who died young.
Right.
I consider wrestling an art too. So.
Yes. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. So, J.D. Rieger, thank you for being on Storyboard 30.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
So, coming up here real soon, folks, we've got, once again, October 6th at the Memphis Listening Lab, which is where we are now, which is in Crosstown, just in case you're not sure where that was, where it is. Listening Lab is upstairs, second floor at Crosstown. So, free admission, your listening party, Thursday, 10-6. Friday, October 14th at the High Tone upstairs, and that's the Subteens, J.D. Rieger and the Cold-Blooded Three, and Alice Pop.
Actually,
I'm sorry, and Alicia Pop.
Actually, that Alicia Pop had to drop off, and we've replaced Alicia with Cease and Desist, formerly known as Negro Terror.
Ah, okay, excellent, okay. And then finally, Saturday, October 15th at Wiseacre, the big tap room downtown. And that is the Subteens, J.D. Rieger and the Cold-Blooded Three, Rosie and...
Loose Opinions and Spacer.
And Spacer is... The wording is spaced out.
Yeah, they put a space in between each letter in the word to really drive the spacer home for you.
That's right.
And plus, we have comedians Katrina Coleman and Brian Balow hosting that show on the 15th, too.
On the 15th?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, excellent. Okay. Very cool. All right. So, once again, J.D. Rieger, thank you so much.
Thank you again. Backtothelight.net. I'll just keep saying it. Thank you.
Yes. Listen in. And thank you, Jim Cole, Listening Lab.
Yes, sir.
Everyone says I should move on, but my heart won't let me rest.
You've been listening to Storyboard 30 from FM 89.3 WYPL. Thanks again to my guest J.D. Rieger for the use of a few cuts from his album Where Wasn't I? And to Jim Cole of the Memphis Listening Lab for use of the space at Crosstown Concourse. And as always, thanks to WYPL producer Vance Durbin, and to you listeners and supporters of the library and FM 89.3. This has been your host, Mark Fleischer, inviting you to join us next time on Storyboard 30 for more conversation with those Memphis personalities and shapers who make our lives here in the Bluff City just a little bit better. Memphis, be safe out there, and make it a great week.